I am 48. The 29th of April, 2001, to the 28th of April, 2002. Over. How many numbers do you have? By Simon Petum. Middle age is a curious concept. Being a part of your life that doesn't really belong in the middle. Rather, it comes somewhere closer to your end of days. I guess most British people consider it to start somewhere in your mid-40s and perhaps end in your 60s. So middle age isn't even one third of your life, perhaps lasting just under 20 years. For me, age 48, I decided middle age had now ended, having run from the age of 24 until now. My middle age was going to be approximately one-third of my life. Okay, I had to stay alive until 72 to achieve the balance this concept required, but I could live with that, or even better, die with that. I've always loved numbers and appreciated their significance, using them in my work throughout my varied careers. Several of my projects are named using numbers. My book title, 45, inspired by the revolutions per minute required to play a 7-inch single. It is a universal concept, certainly in the Western world, to know that 7 and 45 are bonded by the shared experience of placing a piece of black plastic on a turntable and lowering the needle. But I digress. The real reason why 48 should signify the end of middle age is this. 48 is divisible by 2, 3, 4, 6, 8, 12, 16 and 24. I had a concept for a new way of measuring my life experience. Dividing my age in 2 gave me 24. And at the end of my middle age, I knew I now had half of the energy I did when I had been half of my current age. Dividing by 3 reduced me to the age of 16. And now I had just a third of the determination I had back then. Age 12, I had 4 times the imagination. Age 8, 6 times the ability to create a story from what surrounded me. Age 6, I had 8 times the ability to believe in things. Ages 2, 3 and 4 were obviously harder to quantify, but I guess around ages 2 or 3, I would have had 16 or 24 times the wonder I had at the world compared to the end of my middle age. Like all great concepts, it still required some work. Now I owned this concept. I had the ability to allow life to be broken down into manageable chunks. I could try to count my projects, measure my successes, tot up my failures, or even picture my waistline and hairline every 2, 3, 4, 6, 8, 12, 16 or 24 years. Then, on the 11th of September 2001, I realised that my love of numbers was being challenged. 2 towers, 4 aeroplanes, 2,996 deaths. Even this horrific terrorist event was to become known by 2 numbers, 9/11. 2 numbers bonded together, just like 7 and 45. But instead of that 3 or 4 minute burst of oral pleasure, they would instead bring those images and memories. On that Tuesday morning, I was standing in my front room in my house in a village called Wingrave, looking out the window across the Vale of Aylesbury at the Chilterns, when my partner's brother phoned me to tell me to switch on the TV. And as I did, the second plane flew into the second tower. He had just got back from living in New York. As that day progressed into the rest of the week, and then into the months following, the news was picked over, each reported act of heroism seemingly waiting to be superseded by the next act of heroism, as if the world was looking for enough positive acts to counter those of hatred that had brought us here. And as I pondered on what we had witnessed, I wondered if there was a difference between the numbers I loved and what would become the statistics of 9/11. On the night of 9/11, I looked at the picture that sat above my bed, Richard Long's A Smell of Sulphur in the Wind. It was a purchase I'd made some years earlier, an indulgence, if you like, spending some of the money earned as an unlikely pop star, instead of blowing it all on women and a cocaine habit. The accomplice and I spent a lot of what we made on projects, often artistic, and on things that stoked our passions. After all, what had been the point of all that money if we couldn't do something interesting with it? I looked deeply into the picture that Tuesday night, wondering what I could do to reclaim the positive power of numbers. My numbers. My fucking numbers. I started to imagine how many pieces you could cut the work of art into. Maybe like a grid or even a jigsaw. 1,000-piece jigsaw? Nah, too easy. 1,000-piece jigsaws aren't that hard, really. How about 2,000 pieces? Then I began to picture the 2-year-old me. What would he have thought? But he was too young for the idea of what a jigsaw was. So I moved on to the 8-year-old Bill, with his 6 times the ability to create a story from the things around him. He would want a bigger number, something far more impressive to make a grander story. How about 20,000 pieces? The work of art had cost me $20,000 when I bought it, so a dollar a piece seemed perfect. The more I thought about it, the more I could feel the restoration of the balance returning to my numbers. This would be the perfect project to start the final third of my life with. I was going to be an artist now that didn't just write books, but made circles, made beds, made slogans, made journeys, and an artist who made numbers matter to all these individual projects and those I hadn't even invented yet. 8-year-old Bill was excited, but 24-year-old Bill was worried if I had enough time left.
Under 40 Stolen Records by Mark Didmon. On my 48th birthday, I thought about the previous summer. It had been disappointing. My plan to sell the Richard Long A Smell of Sulphur in the Wind artwork hadn't worked out. It was now almost a year since I'd driven up the UK trying to get rid of it. Now, all the for sale placards had been taken down, and the sales pitches in Nottingham, Dundee and elsewhere were largely forgotten. No one would give me $20,000 for it, and it was still hanging on my bedroom wall. Without selling it, I couldn't complete my work, A Smell of Money Underground. I should probably have done that publicity stunt in Bristol after all, the one I'd planned to have in a gallery across town on the same day Richard Long's own show opened at the Royal Academy. Something had made me cancel. A last-minute doubt. A worry it would be cheap and shallow, that I would look like an ex-pop star craving attention. But I still wanted rid of the thing. In the meantime, the dreams were becoming increasingly frequent, darker and more vivid. Each time I was on the banks of the Black Loch in Galloway, watching different figures throwing stones into the dark water and seeing my life reflected and passing through the disappearing ripples. Now, though, the stones being thrown were parts of the artwork, each one a tiny piece of the photograph floating outwards into the dark water. 14 August 2001, 2:32 a.m. I'd write about this moment later in How to Be an Artist, explaining what I'd done and why. But the truth is, I don't really remember planning any of it or what actually happened. I'd had another of those dreams, but this time I awoke holding a black marker and ruler, manically drawing lines onto the Richard Long artwork, dividing it into pieces. I would cut it up and throw each one into the Black Loch. It would be a new work, a smell of sulphur in the water. It wasn't the first time in my career that my dark subconscious made me destroy something significant. Scissorman, Scissorman, Scissorman. But next morning I woke with a new thought. By drawing more lines, I could divide Richard Long's artwork into 20,000 equal-sized pieces. If I sold each one for $1, I'd still break up the artwork and get rid of it, just without throwing it into the Black Loch. And I'd get the $20,000 for my own work, A Smell of Money Underground. What followed was a dark blur of hectic, feverishly focused activity, drawing lines, planning the shows, where I'd try to sell bits of the artwork, making posters, listing possible venues. When I was done, I made tea and turned on the TV. It was now the afternoon of 16 August. I'd lost a whole day somewhere, but at least I had a plan again. The light on my answer phone was blinking with missed calls. McCartney's lawyer had left another message. "Bill, pick up. You can't ignore me forever. We need to talk." "Okay, I'll call back." I'd written before, in 17, that as a kid in 1967, I bought my first record, The Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever. It opened a door for me. I was completely transported by it and became obsessive, playing it over and over and over. What I'd never written about is what that obsession drove me to. The morning I bought it, the day of release, I must have played that record 20 or 30 times on our old dance set. But then I made a mistake. Lifting the needle after the song finished, I put a deep scratch on the vinyl. My record was ruined. I spent the next few hours running between Corby's record shops, trying to buy another, but by then, everywhere was sold out. I was desperate. From the sleeve, I knew the record was pressed at EMI's plant just outside London. It wasn't that far away. I got the train down, aiming to buy or blag one at the factory gates. That didn't go well. No one there would sell me a copy, and the guys loading boxes of the single into vans outside the plant told me to get lost. I had no other choice. When the coast was clear, I stole a whole box. Now I had 40 copies of Strawberry Fields Forever, all of my own. Anyway, I didn't tell anyone about that until 99. I was in Liverpool talking music trivia with a friend who told me Strawberry Fields Forever only reached number 2 in the UK singles chart because Engelbert Humperdinck's Release Me outsold it by something like 30 copies in its first week. I told him what I'd done. Maybe my stolen box had made the difference. Word soon spread through the Liverpool music scene. McCartney's lawyer found out and wasn't happy. The Answerphone message made me think about that time in my life. My obsession with Strawberry Fields Forever and the music I was listening to now, so many years later. Was the music of my youth better than today's? I simply couldn't believe that and had to prove it. From then on, I vowed only to listen to new music, recorded by new bands. Over the coming months, I listened to hundreds of new albums. I still vividly remember the first one, the frenetic, raging noise rock of Six by Seven's The Closer You Get. 28 April 2002, the day before my 49th birthday. Another restless night. The Black Loch dreams were a thing of the past. I now dreamt endlessly of those 40 stolen singles. I woke at dawn with a clear purpose. I picked daffodils at the park near my London flat, got the bus to the former site of the EMI pressing plant in Hayes, and gave away 40 bunches to complete strangers.